Let me see, who else is that? They had, oh, Lou Burdett. He was another one of them herky jerky squirming guys, always making, wanted to make you think he was throwing you a spitter all the time. He'd let him up or not. But you'd get that thought in your mind. And then if you didn't, you know, if you fouled one off or you got hit on the hand or you didn't get a base, it's like, oh, I threw me that spitter. They don't know. Blame that pitcher for that, you know. Roger Hornsby would always say, well, it doesn't make any difference, Jim, which hand they throw with, right or left. If you're a big leaguer, they got to throw that ball in the strike zone. And if it's in the strike zone, you ought to hit it. So it, this platooning, Roger Hornsby didn't believe in it. He didn't like it. He didn't believe in it. He said, if you're a big leaguer, you ought to be able, if the ball's in the strike zone, you ought to be able to hit it. I said, he'd tell me, he said, I don't care if he throws it with his foot. What difference does it make? It's got to come here in this strike zone. If it comes, the ball comes in that strike zone, then you got to hit the ball. And if you can't do that, you don't belong in the big leagues. And that's just the way he taught. And a lot of people didn't like that, but that was the fact. But platooning was a second guessing, helped the manager get the second guessers from the stands, the news media, or the owners, or whoever, off his back. Because they'd say, well, you got a good right-hand hitter and there's a left-hand pitcher, and supposedly, which is not always the case, but in a lot of cases true, that a right-hander hits a left-hander better than he does a right, and vice versa. And but it didn't make any difference to me which hand he threw at, because Roger Hornsby taught me and installed that in my brain. It doesn't make any difference. And I hit as good, if not better, often right-handers than I did left-handers. In fact, the Braves Rookie of the Year, Dave Justice, hit 3-something often left-handers, and he's a left-hand hitter, and only 280, I say only, but he had a good year, but 280-something often right-handers. So he proved that left-hander doesn't make really that much difference if you get up there and swing that bat. That's the main thing. A lot of guys fear. You have fear in your eyes, and it hurts.
Do you get to many games during the season?
No. In fact, I get to just about zero anymore. First of all, I don't like to get in that traffic going to Atlanta. I've been out here for 30 years now in West Country when I moved out here. Now it's heavy suburban. But I just don't like to fight the traffic. And then the stadium's not located in the ideal place as far as I'm concerned, and so I don't go to many games. I go to, if I'm invited to an old timers game, I go to play. But then we just go, my wife and I, we'll go, Catherine and I'll go, we'll go to the hotel where we're staying, and from there we get on the team bus and go to the ballpark and then come back to the hotel and we get in our car and come home. And but I don't stay down in Atlanta much. And we used to, when we first met back in 1947, I was stationed out at Fort McPherson on Lee Street. And I used to ride the trolley downtown to change, come out on Mariota Street where she lived, pick her up. We'd ride the trolley back down, walk all over Atlanta, go to the show, get a hot dog, win the shop, and to 11, 12 o'clock at night and never think any more about it. But now you can't go 20 feet down there if you don't get run over by somebody or somebody's robbing you or mugging you or something. So we just don't go anymore. We stay out here in the country, or in suburbia, as it is now. And when we go somewhere, it's usually north or around Atlanta and down to Florida or somewhere. But we very seldom go to the stadium. And and there, too, there's so many games on TV now. We get cable. And I like to watch the Cubs because they're playing at old Wrigley Field. Beautiful ballpark. My third best park. First, the park I love the best and miss the most, of course, is Crosley Field. Then Ebbets Field. And Ebbets Field for two reasons. One is a great hitter's ballpark. And two is where I hit my first major league home run. Great memories at Ebbets Field. And the fans and the old Brooklyn Dodger fans were so great. And if you've done something good on that field as a player, whether you be a Dodger or a visiting club, they were up giving you a standing ovation, and it's go great going. And they were just great fans and great people. And I loved to go there. That was a great place to go play. It was like going to the circus, just a great place. The fans were sometimes more interesting than the game going on in the field. They were just great. I loved that. That was my second park that I loved the best. Then Wrigley Field was my third. I loved Wrigley Field for two reasons, too. One's a beautiful ivory. It was a great ballpark, but you played in the daytime all the time. And baseball was invented by old Abner Doubleday, I think, or whoever. They say Doubleday, and then you hear historians talking about somebody else, but whoever thought of it was made to be played in the daytime. And that's a daytime sport. And Of course, it won't be probably the next 10, maybe 20 years. It'll all be indoors. And that, so they won't lose any gates with the rain out and stuff, I guess. I don't know. It's got to be so much money. I tell you, it's amazing. I don't begrudge the players for getting money. I think that's a wonderful thing. Life is so short as a professional athlete that you need to make whatever it is you can, that you can demand. If you can demand those figures and get them, I'm amazed at a guy that can hit 220, drive in 16 runs, and not even come close to winning a fielding average or Golden Glove or anything, can demand $1 million a year and get it. I mean, that's amazing to me. But there's a lot more teams, of course. In those days, there was only 8 teams in each league, 16 teams, and jobs were scarce. And if you got out of that lineup for any length of time, you might not get back in it. That's proved in a lot of cases in the Yankee organization, especially. Because they had, like, in the Dodgers, both of those organizations and the Red Sox had players, you know, they had some of them had 4,000 or 5,000 ball players under contract all the time. And I think when they broke the reserve clause, Major League Baseball reserve clause went out, and now the players can arbitrate, they can do this and that and the other. They got lawyers and attorneys and all this people talking for them. They don't have to really think about whatever they do. All they have to do is think about playing baseball, and half of them don't even want to do that, it seems like. And by the way they play, it shows that they don't practice, because they don't play. The caliber of the game at the Major League level has really sunk down, with the exception for 2 or 3 teams. Now, the Dodgers always play good fundamental baseball. You watch the Dodgers, and that's because Vero Beach, that's like a baseball factory down there, and it's a wonderful thing to see that and go down there and see. And they got a great guy, Mr. Baseball, Tommy Lasorda. Great, great guy. And great for baseball. I think the world of Tommy Lasorda. But there's so many of the players that they're building up as superstars that couldn't play. Well, they'd be hard-pressed to make what we call the extra man on the ball club, our utility players. Back in the 40s and 50s. And that's not, I'm not saying that because I played there and at that time, but from what I see and from what I know, what it takes to play in the big leagues at that time and what they're doing today, my gosh, it's a cakewalk. I wish I could play today. I had a lifetime batting average of 280 right in there somewhere, and I'd be a millionaire. And, you know, I wouldn't have to be fooling, chasing all these warts down and everything.
Well, sort of between you and me, you may have not noticed this, but at that card show, I was much more interested in speaking with you and Mr. Nixon than I was with Dave Justice. All respect to Dave Justice, but you know, he hasn't proven himself yet.
No, he's just getting started. But you know, David has got a wonderful attitude, and I hope he keeps it. He has got a great attitude, and he's got a super swing at that ball. He's as close to Ted Williams as I've ever seen. And Willard and I agree on that. Willard used to dress right next to Ted. Willard with the Red Sox, if he doesn't get on what so many of them do, and that's that ego trip, and say, hey, I'm going to do one thing. I'm going to be the very best baseball player I can possibly be, and work at it. Then he can be a superstar.
Who are the ball players today that you think would have been successful in any era?
Well, you know, it boils down to really very few. I think the kid that's playing second base for Chicago would have had a chance.
Sandberg.
Sandberg is a tough competitor out there, and he's always working on the game. He has his bad days, but so does everybody. But he seems like he concentrates on the game. Now, I don't know the names of a lot of the guys that I've watched play because I'm not following it really that close because the other things overshadowed. I could tell you some bad plays that guys that wouldn't have been there long. They'd have had a bus ticket in their locker. And Jose Canseco was one of them. He's a great guy, big guy with a lot of power. But he can be pitched to as the Dodgers showed in the World Series and as the kids last year, the Cincinnati showed in their World Series against him. And he's a terrible outfielder. He almost got hit in the head with a ball that he should have caught. It almost hits him in the head, and then he don't know what to do with it after he gets it. He's got a good, strong arm. He's physically. And that's the thing that amazes me, too, when we're talking about that. These guys today are such physical specimens. They got all the Nautilus equipment, and they've got tremendous athletic bodies. They don't know what to do with it. That's the problem. They go in there and work on the machine. I guess maybe because you can sit down and do this stuff or ride a bike or whatever. But they're a great physical specimen. They're all in great shape. But they don't practice playing baseball. It's like a mechanic going out and looking at a car and saying, oh, I can fix that, and don't know what tool to use. They just don't know what to do with the great ability that they have and the great physical strength. They can make anything. First of all, there's no such thing as a natural anything. There's not anything that's a natural hitter. There's not a natural fielder, a natural pitcher, a natural thrower, whatever. You have the God-given talents. You have the physical ability. What you do to cultivate that and make yourself the ultimate ball player, in this case, baseball player, you have to do through your mind and your determination and your heart. And you got to have the heart to go out there and face the rejection of making mistakes and the rejection of sometimes 40,000 people on your back. But you keep driving to become the very best you could possibly be. And these guys don't do that. You don't see them practice. I was down in an old-timers game at the Braves Stadium. We're in the dressing room. Pee Wee Reese and I are sitting there together. And there's another great ball player, Pee Wee Reese. Boy, he was steady. If there was ever a steady Eddie, that's him. He's always there with that bat or with that glove in that field. He didn't make sensational plays. He made the everyday play that you have to make to win ball games. The sensational, this jumping up in the air and lollipop and throw, that's a bunch of baloney. Everybody's trying now, it seems like, to make a play in the outfield or around the infield to get on the Play of the Week award, whatever the hell that thing is. And that, you know, you see them doing all kinds of crazy things, and they play terrible about that. Pee-wee was just out there, the ball's hit to him, he goes over, he gets it, he throws a guy out, give it a go to the next guy. And that's the way those guys played in those days. These guys, and then they would make sensational plays. That Roy McMillan would go in the hole and back of third base and stretch out along that ground, backhand that ball, come up, plant that foot, and fire a rocket to first base. The guy's out. These guys today, they go over there, they backhand the ball, they jump up in the air like they're flying or doing a ballerina or something, and they flip the ball, and there's no way in the world they're going to throw him out with that kind of a thing. And then they say, oh, what a great play he made. Well, he didn't. He didn't make a great play. He made a, in my opinion, when I look at it, he made a complete fool of himself. If he's a major leaguer, he should have been over there grabbing that ball, coming up and firing that thing and getting that guy out, because you've got to get him out. But anyway, that's the way we lived, and this is the way these guys live today. And sometimes you wonder.
If you were an owner and all of the managers you played for and against, who would you hire?
Of all of that I played for and against, who would I hire? Boy. Now, there's so many. Each one of them had their own special quality in the way I look at things. Now, I don't look at things like everybody, of course, but if I, gosh, that's a hard question, because like Roger Hornsby was my favorite man. Two reasons. One, he was good to me. He showed me respect as a kid, and he liked my attitude and my going for the game. And I always thought he was great, and guys on the ball club that hated him. And baseball, just as pure baseball manager of thinking, I guess, Bill Rigney was right in there, Bertie Tibbetts that I played for was right in there, great psychological guy, great thinker, thinking two or three innings ahead, Stanky. Eddie Stanky was a great ball player and a good manager. He wanted that fire in there and always thinking of a way to beat you. And, just so many guys with different styles. Gosh.
That's a tough question.
It's hard. I think probably the most, and Casey Stengel. Oh, I love Casey Stengel. Casey Stengel told me in 1977, we were at Cincinnati in an old-timers game. And I came into this clubhouse. And here's Casey sitting down over here. And he looked up and he saw me. And I hadn't seen Casey to speak to for 25 years. 1952.
You were in the Yankee organization.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And I walked through that clubhouse door, and he looked up. He was putting his uniform on, getting ready. He was our manager for the old timers game. And he looked up and he says, "Jim, come here, man, sit down. And patted the stool next to him. "I want to tell you something." Well, my mouth dropped open. I was flabbergasted that he even knew who I was to start with. "Hey, son, I want to tell you why I made that trade." I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "Your power was straight away, and I needed a guy to win me 4 ball games at the end of 1952. Blackwell was the guy. Cincinnati wanted you. I didn't want to get ready. We're going to bring you up the next year. We're going to bring you up 53. But when we got to thinking about it, Yankee Stadium wasn't built for a hitter like you, because your power is straight away, and that's a big part of the field out there. Balls that you'd hit out of park in other parks would be caught out there from right center to left center field. If you'd been a pull hitter, more of a pull hitter, then you'd have been okay. But pull hitters are the only ones that ever really survived in Yankee Stadium. The guys that hit straight away didn't hit many home runs and didn't last long. So we had to take that into account, and that's the reason that we finally okayed that trade, and Roger Hornsby was insistent that you were his guy. They wanted you bad, and that's why we made the trade. And I've been wanting to tell you that, and this is the first time I saw it. I just wanted to tell you that, son, and I hope there's no hard feelings about that. That's Mr. Stink. There certainly isn't. But then we got to talking, and he told me, said, "You know, managing the Yankees in his own way, his own Stingalese talking, oh, such a man." He'd say, "You know," he said, "I could manage the Yankees from a hotel room." He said, "All I have to do with my ball club is go out there and pick out 8 guys to play their position and a pitcher. Give the umpire the scorecard, tell the guys who's going, and then get back out of the way and let them play. Because all the Yankees, through their D-ball all the way to the big leagues, know how to play the game. You're taught that from the very first day you become a Yankee. All the way through in those days. Not so today, but in those days. And the system is always the same. So when you got to the big club, you didn't have to be shown or taught, and you didn't have school and class in spring training in the big leagues. You were ready to play the game. And now it's a question, can you play it? Are you good enough defensively? Have you got a strong enough arm? Can you hit well enough? And so on. And that's what they look for in spring training. They wasn't going to school and teaching you this and that and the other, because you already knew that coming through their minor league system. So he said, "All I have to do," said, "I don't even have to show up at the ballpark, but I didn't want to." Said, "I show up so I can talk to reporters. I have fun talking to them." And that's what he told me. And I could not believe that man. He was such a great man. And he was no dummy, because you don't become president of 2 banks and be a dummy. I mean, he had some kind of smarts, but he was so, and he didn't miss anything. People say, "Oh, you know, you go to sleep on the bench." He didn't go to sleep. But he never missed anything. And he could look back and tell you, just like me walking in that clubhouse, he maybe saw me, that I know of, 3 times in his entire life, and all of it was in spring training. And I don't know if he ever saw me any other times or not. If he did, I wasn't aware of it. But 19, after 20-some years of just, listen, here's a guy, you know, we traded, and that was him. But Chicago used to give him a bad time when I go to Chicago. The White Sox announcers, they'd always get me on the radio show. I was always good for $50 or a radio or a watch or something. So when I went to Cincinnati or to Chicago, because they always wanted me to talk about Stingle. They're always trying to wrap Stingle in the Yankees. And they'd use me because he traded me away. And they'd say, "Well, I wonder how Casey feels about trading Jim Greengrass today. You know, I hit 2 home runs or something." And especially if they happened to be in a little slump and the White Sox were doing good, or they were doing good against me, you know, they'd always bring that up. In Chicago, yeah.
Well, I get the feeling that Casey Stengel might be the person you would have hired.
If I was an owner and had my choice all the way back through the years of the guys that I knew to run to, probably Stengel. And I'd like to, and I tell you who the coaches would be. I wouldn't have Roger Hornsby on third base. He got me in trouble at third base. I'd have Roger as my hitting coach. I'd have Stan Musial at third base, coaching. have Bertie Tibbetts would be there and the coaching staff to handle the psychological things in the ball club and the clubhouse problems and those kind of things. And I guess Freddie Hutchinson, I'd have old Freddie there for just some, put some fire into the pitching staff. Boy, he was tough. He'd find pitchers. He didn't knock you down. He'd find them. In fact, it got so bad, we were playing St. Louis. He was the manager at St. Louis. And Harvey Haddix was pitching. Clues hitting. And Gus or somebody hit a home run in front of him. And Hutchinson, damn! And Harvey stopped there. You know, little old Harvey's throwing that ball. And Harvey throws one in close to that. That'll be $150. And Clue standing up there. And so Harvey hit him with a fastball right there. Clue never moved. Boom. Ball hit him and bounced back to him. Clue just, you never see Clue mad. Gentle giant. He just come around like this and he had a fence post for a bat. He just Ray got up in his neck. He took that bat and slammed it against the ground and it just shattered. This fence post shattered. And Haddix took off for left field. He thought he was coming out of there after him. But that was the kind of fiery guy that Hutchinson was. And I knocked up when Stanky was managing him, and I come into home plate and knocked their catcher down and scored a winning run. And he was blocking the plate. And I come in and he was getting the ball and me and everything got there at the same time. And I hit him pretty good and flipped him all over and just basking, chest protector and shin guards and everything went everywhere. And I was bruised up pretty good as well, but he dropped the ball and I scored the winning run. And the Cardinal guys really got on my case about the old dirty play and, you know, you didn't have to do that and all that. And boy, you could hear Case or hear Eddie in the clubhouse through the walls to our clubhouse saying, "You bunch of so-and-sos, don't jump on that kid for knocking him down." I said, "That's the way you ought to be playing the damn game. He's just doing his job, which is something you guys ain't doing." Boy, he was right. And he backed me up on that. And he said, "No, you done the right thing, kid. You done, that's the way you ought to play the game. And that's the way these crybabies ought to be played or so. They wouldn't be crybabies." That made me feel pretty good. Yeah. I didn't mean to hit the guy, hurt him, and knock him unconscious, I guess, for a short spell. But still, I knew that my job was to get into that base, and he had me blocked. I had to go through it or stop. They tagged me out, and that was a winning run. I wasn't fixing to stop. And so guys like that, fiery guys and ready to play, get out there. And what they called in those days, I guess, Dizzy Dean and Mel, I want to talk about. So we'd play. They'd be talking and say, "Yeah, we'll play hell for leather." That's the way the gas house game plays. "We just get out there and play like hell, boys. That's why we play this game. And that's the way it ought to be played. You play to win. When it's over with, you all get together and go have a beer or a soda pop and sit down and have lunch and tell stories and have a big time." When that game started, those guys in the gray were your enemy. And if you were in the white, if you were the home team, always dressed at home, always dressed in white, and the road teams were always in gray. If you're the home team, them guys are your enemies. You might be your best of friends off that field, but you were doing anything you could to beat that rascal during that ball game. And that's the way they played, and that's the way they lived. And they never worried about money. Today, these guys are all worrying about money. Stocks and bonds or whatever. How many endorsements can I get? Instead of thinking about how to play the game, how to win.
You mentioned managers as coaches, but you had some fiery people who were coaches for you. I mean, Dick Bartell was one of your coaches.
Dickie Bartell.
And I don't know how you could get much more fiery than that. And I believe Whit Wyatt had a...
Well, Whitlow was a great pitching coach and would have been a great major league manager, but he didn't want to manage in the big leagues. He managed here, you know, with the Crackers. Won a championship and a little World Series.
He's from Georgia, isn't he?
Yes, he's from Buchanan right up here. Whitlow was just a great man, a great gentleman, just a great guy, but a tough competitor. There again, one of them gentle giants. Boy, just as nice as he could be off the field. You put that glove, get that ball in his hand, put him out on that mound, and he would knock you down. And if you got up and complained, he'd knock you down again.
Joe DiMaggio said he was the meanest pitcher he ever faced.